Hello, dear listener, and also the cheap ones, and welcome to episode 7 of Positive Thinking and the Meaning of Life. My name is contractually Marcus Freestone. This episode is about consciousness. We all have it, but what exactly is it? This question has been asked for thousands of years, yet still there is no definitive answer. The universe operates on a fairly basic set of laws, and we understand them well enough to launch satellites and send people to the moon and back. However, the human brain is far more complex, and we're nowhere near a complete explanation of how the 100 billion neurons in our head combine to form our conscious experience of ourselves and the world. That said, many strides forward have been made in recent years, utilising new technology and techniques. So let's take a look at consciousness and see how it fits into our ever-expanding picture of positive thinking and the meaning of life. Consciousness is to be conscious of something, a level of awareness. But that doesn't mean that we can trust our consciousness to give us an accurate representation of reality. In phantom limb syndrome, amputees report feeling conscious of the missing limb in exactly the same manner as when the limb in question was still attached to them. People with a missing arm will reach to pick up an object, and everything in their central nervous system and brain is telling them that the arm is moving through space towards the object, when of course it isn't. Less dramatically, people who are colorblind are receiving false information from the external world. Therefore, we must naturally ask the question, how does our consciousness interact with the external world? Consciousness has been a subject much debated by philosophers, then physicians, mystics, and priests, and now by neuroscientists. The main problem of consciousness is that the only tool available to study it with is, yes, you've guessed it, consciousness. We can never get outside of consciousness to examine it from an objective distance. My Pocket Dictionary defines conscious as 1. Alert and awake, 2. Aware, 3. Deliberate or intentional. My Dictionary of Psychology describes consciousness as a character belonging to certain processes or events in the living organism, which must be regarded as unique and therefore as indefinable in terms of anything else, but which can best be described as a view of these processes or events, as it were, from the inside. The individual is inside what is happening. Therefore, in a sense, consciousness is an epiphenomenon. It cannot exist without something external of which to be conscious. It could be seen as a mere umbrella term for our collection of senses and impressions, but is usually taken from all quarters to mean much more than that. And this is the very problem that we're dealing with in this episode, and I feel that this is going to be a 2 or 3 parter, this episode, because yeah, of course, I'm not going to sum up consciousness in half an hour, am I? That's ridiculous. But it's a bit like trying to come up, well, I think it's exactly the same as trying to come up with the physicist's so-called theory of everything, which would be a theory that united quantum theory and gravity, which we both know are correct, and yet they contradict each other because they're describing different things. And I think it's the same with any theory of consciousness and theories and observations about the external world. We can measure the external world, what we call reality, but we're doing it via consciousness, and there's no other way of doing it. So what is the relationship between individual subjective consciousness and objective external reality? That's what we're really talking about. So we're going to be talking about how the human brain works, how we process sense data, and how we measure and codify and categorize the external world. It's those two things together that we have to use to explain consciousness. It's generally accepted that human beings are conscious and lower animals are not. In that sense, consciousness is another word for awareness of self, or a secondary level of cognition, whereby you are aware both of an object or event and of yourself as the viewer. The secondary level of thinking is what has allowed us as a species to create music, literature, science, philosophy, etc. We cannot discuss consciousness without referring to the unconscious. When I say the unconscious or subconscious, the terms are interchangeable, I'm not referring to a Freudian filing cabinet of filth which rules your life. That idea has now been almost universally dismissed, except by those who make lots of money by uncovering, or implanting in reality, false memories in patients who keep going to see them every week for years and years. In split brain patients, where the corpus callosum connecting the two hemispheres of the brain has been severed, usually to cure severe epilepsy, or in someone who has had a severe stroke in one side of the brain, they lose the ability to consciously see objects on one side of their vision and will verbally report that they can see nothing whatsoever. However, if you place an object where they cannot see it and ask them to draw the object or write down the name of it, they can do it correctly, but will report that they have no idea why they drew or wrote down what they did. In other words, an unconscious part of the brain still has perfect vision, but due to the malfunction of a specific brain region, the unconscious is not telling the conscious that it can see, and therefore the person is unaware of being able to see. This is one of many examples of the conscious and unconscious brain not cooperating with each other and causing mental confusion. Consciousness is generally understood to be our subjective internal sense of our own selves, qualia, as psychologists and philosophers have christened it. But we all feel that it is so much more than that. We feel that there is a single central I inside us, the me that looks out upon the world, thinks about our situation, our environment and other people, and comes to some conscious decisions about what we should do with our lives and how we should act. Some people call this the soul, others call it the mind. They are all equally wrong. We can certainly dismiss the soul as an outdated, unnecessary metaphysical abstraction, which is simply not needed to explain human thought and behaviour. But can the same be said of the mind, the thing which for centuries has been held up by science and philosophy as the grand centre of all that is human? It would seem that the answer is yes. I've always thought that the whole concept of the mind was unnecessary. To me, it smacked of woolly religious-style reasoning. There is a lump of grey porridge in our head that contains all our thoughts, memories, plans and emotions. It is called the brain, and it can be weighed and measured, after you've died, preferably, and we can put it in a scanner and physically record which areas of the brain are working when you engage in a particular mental or physical task. Thus, we've been able in recent years to begin drawing a complex, highly accurate map showing which clusters of neurons are active during, for example, the reading of words and the hearing of words, two completely different, unconnected areas. Imagining carrying out a physical task, which to the brain is exactly the same as physically doing the task, recalling certain distant memories, etc. In this way, we now know that the brain is modular in nature, with specific tasks occurring in distinct neuronal clusters, and that there is no central processing unit in the brain as there is in a computer. The brain-computer analogy does have a limited validity, but they are fundamentally different because a computer has been designed all at once and therefore has a centralized logical command structure, whereas the brain evolved over 3 billion years and is therefore decentralized with individual areas concentrating on specific tasks, entirely independent of other areas and functions. The human brain is like this because, as I say, it's evolved over so many years, and different parts of the brain were designed, if you want to use that word, at different times, and it's all just fitted on top of each other. Going back to brain injury or malfunction, we now know that, for example, someone can lose the ability to read language but retain the ability to read music because there are two entirely separate functions located in different brain regions. As this is the case, surely it becomes impossible to think of us as being a holistic personality. And surely, as we can now measure all conceivable mental activity occurring within the physical brain, it also makes the need for a metaphysical mind wholly redundant. So, how are we going to develop an accurate picture of the relationship between consciousness and external reality? I think that some current scientific work is going at a dead end. Science progresses by developing hypotheses and then experimentally obtaining empirical verification. If this verification is not forthcoming, then the hypothesis is amended or abandoned. At least, that's how science is supposed to work. It seems to me that in the realm of quantum theory, we have a situation where things like quarks, which have never been observed, are talked about in the same manner as gravity, as if they've been proved beyond all doubt. Much of quantum theory sounds rather too much like fanciful science fiction to me, especially all the talk of parallel universes and time travel. And parallel universes are something which, in physics, can never be proved or accessed. Therefore, science should not be proposing them as a reality, because it can never be proved, and that is not science. In the book Quantum Theory Cannot Hurt You, Marcus Chown says, "Imagine a roulette wheel and a ball bouncing around as the wheel spins. We think of the number that ball comes to rest on when the wheel finally halts as inherently unpredictable. But if it were possible to know the initial trajectory of the ball and so on, the laws of physics should be used to predict with 100% certainty where the ball will end up. The same is true with the tossing of a coin." I completely disagree with this example. Firstly, it is impossible to know the way that air currents will change and affect every single particle in the room during the spin, because the interaction of particles is fundamentally unpredictable, and therefore not even a time machine could predict the exact path of the ball. Secondly, what if somebody slips and spills their drink on the roulette wheel? Can you predict the precise consequences of that as well? And what if someone were to make the decision to simply pick up the ball or stop the wheel by hand? Can you predict the exact combination of electrochemical impulses in somebody's brain and what actions that will lead them to perform? Of course you can't. If this were possible, then surely with modern computing power, we could produce weather reports that are 100% infallible, which we clearly don't. In the book, Marcus Chown continues, "Nothing in the everyday world is fundamentally unpredictable. Nothing is truly random. The reason we cannot predict the outcome of the game of roulette or of the toss of a coin is that there is simply too much information for us to take into account. But in principle, and this is the key point, there is nothing to prevent us from predicting both." Well, if we're going to go down that route, then we could say that in principle, there's nothing to prevent us predicting the exact position in space I will be occupying on June the 14th, 2039 at 4:21 p.m. However, just because something is theoretically possible, that doesn't mean that it can ever be practically possible. And I'm sure most people would agree that my example would be utterly impossible to calculate, even with computing technology from millions of years in the future. Following this example, in 2039, I will be 67 years old, and there is a distinct possibility that I may by then be dead. I've recently reconsidered my stance on reductionism. I wrote a note on my phone a while ago. You can be reductionist and say that a book is just paper and ink, but that's missing the point. The meaning we get from a good book is so much more. But it's only because we've added meaning to it that a book appears to us to possess meaning. To a cat, it is nothing more than a potential lining for a litter tray. Therefore, I am forced to concede that I have applied reductionism far too rigorously throughout my life. For example, you can describe any object on the planet, including human beings, as a pile of carbon atoms, but that is in no way a useful description. You can describe a colour by its wavelength, but that in no way helps you in deciding whether or not you wish to paint your living room walls with it. The description has to mean something, have some common reference points to the person to whom you are positing the description. A table isn't only a pile of atoms. It also possesses a size, shape, weight, colour, texture, and other properties which help differentiate between one table and another. Conversely, you could go too far in the other direction and describe it merely as a piece of furniture or even an object, which would be of no use in helping a person decide whether or not they should put a cup of tea on it. Therefore, we must endeavour to use descriptions which are neither too reductionist nor too holistic. Turning to the subject of our internal mental experiences, some scientists describe consciousness as nothing more than electrochemical interactions between synapses. That may be a factually accurate description of what is occurring within the brain, but it is useless in trying to understand the human experience. Of course, we can talk about different neurotransmitters, neural pathways, axons and dendrites, but none of this explains why people think and feel and see the world in such vastly different ways. Going to the other extreme, some people describe consciousness in woolly, mystical, holistic terms. This is equally unhelpful. Thinking and feeling are, broadly speaking, the two things we do in our own heads, the constituents of consciousness, I would say. Add physical action and interacting with the external world, and you have a complete, albeit absurdly brief, description of human experience. Albeit on a subconscious, often unnoticed level, we choose our emotional state every second of our lives. Emotions are not something external that happened to us. They are things we choose to do to ourselves. Obviously, I'm expounding the existential view there, emphasizing that we have free will. But of course, emotions usually do not arise merely within our own brain. Although they can do, emotions arise because we experience something in the external world, and then we have an emotional reaction to it in the internal world of our own consciousness. However, although many neuroscientists now describe emotions in a way which equates perfectly with the notion of Gurdjieff's subconscious robot, the picture turns out to be a bit more complex than that. My recent reading on the neuroscience of emotions has led me to compare their unconscious origins with that of our generally outdated stimuli and response system. We haven't evolved during the last 40,000 years and are therefore ill-adapted to modern society because the inner core of our brains still think we're living in caves and banging rocks together. For example, I have developed, or maybe unconsciously stolen, the theory that alarm clocks are incredibly bad for our health because, as well as disrupting our natural sleep cycle, being woken by an unpleasant noise triggers an erroneous danger response, leading to a stressful state of sudden alertness and the sort of ill temper and anxiety displayed by many people during the early morning. In that case, are we merely puppets to an unconscious system of trigger and response? Pavlov's dogs in human clothing, as you almost certainly wouldn't put it. So what I think this leads us to is a situation that we're living in now in the 21st century where our view of external reality is distorted or maybe incomplete or even unpleasant in the case of mental illness because if you look at how much society and technology have evolved just in the last 100 years, never mind the last 40,000 years, if you appreciate that we are looking at this modern digital world through the eyes of cavemen, then are we, in fact, in a true synchronized relationship between our internal consciousness and external reality? Are we interpreting it correctly, or is it the case, as I suspect, that our, if you like, consciousness software is many, many thousands of years out of date for dealing with the hardware of external reality? I've recently had another personal change of mind. I used to be one of those philosophical pedants who insisted that nothing about external reality was knowable. I'd come to believe this because I thought that the distortions arising from the subjective cognitive processing of each person were so great that it was impossible for anyone to agree empirically upon anything at all. Nobody can verify the veracity of anything because they could be dreaming or delusional, etc. However, I've become far less of a philosophical fundamentalist over the last few years. Although studies of eyewitness testimony and general human experience tell us that our sensory faculties are often error-prone, it is simply not the case that nothing can be agreed upon. Unless they have the most severe forms of mental impairment, a massive stroke, brain injury, developmental retardation, or high-level psychosis, including recreational drugs, which would be a tiny fraction of 1% of the population, then everyone can agree on many basic facts about reality. That's a chair, that's a table, that's a car, that's a building, it is snowing, it is sunny, this that I'm drinking is a pint of Guinness and not a cup of tea, etc. Much as a hardline empirical reductionist may believe that everything is subjective and that reality has no meaning, this is clearly not true. Everyone in a crowd knows that they are at a cricket match and not a snooker match, and vice versa. They all agree upon an external reality. But of course, it is still true, and we must all surely admit this from our own experience, that our conscious version of reality can be and is often distorted and incorrect. And there are many factors involved in this. For example, do you believe in ghosts? If you do, you will see them. If you don't, then you won't. The brain has countless dispositional biases which colour our perception of the world. When your brain receives data or sensory input from the external world, it never merely presents it to you as is. Every human being evolves over a lifetime their own unique set of biases and predispositions, and everything you think and experience is filtered, i.e. changed, through those. To return to the opening example of ghosts, our peripheral vision is only 15% accurate. Therefore, when you move your head, it can often seem as if you were seeing something moving out of the corner of your eye. If you are aware of this simple physiological fact and not already predisposed towards the supernatural, you will more than likely ignore this phenomena, as I myself have on the many times that I think I've seen something moving out of the corner of my eye, or have seen something that doesn't seem to immediately coincide with and be explained by my common sense understanding of reality. However, many people would feel that they really did see something moving on the edge of their vision. Of course, when they look towards it, there is nothing there. Some of those people, if sufficiently predisposed, may go on to interpret that as a ghost. This also may be the root of the idea prevalent among the ancient Greeks that all matter was a living entity, so-called animism. In addition, there is also the issue of precedent. Once you have interpreted one of these physiological phenomena as a ghost, you will be far more likely to interpret similar phenomena in the same manner in the future. This is because the brain, though immensely powerful, is also very lazy. It is resource intensive, consuming around 20% of our daily energy supply and nutrients. Therefore, it has to run as efficiently as possible in order to not waste any precious resources. So, when you face a situation or experience, an experience of external reality, your brain conducts a search through your memory for a previous incident of this and prompts you to react in the same manner. Hence, if you were bitten by a dog as a child, your brain will induce a level of anxiety when a dog barks at you because it is preparing your fight or flight mechanism. This will introduce adrenaline into your system, which, if not dissipated by the physical exertion of running away, will remain for a while and produce feelings of stress. So people in such a situation are not behaving illogically or making a mountain out of a molehill. They are merely at the mercy of their central nervous system. And how we view the external world is also a cultural phenomena conditioned by the prevalent views of the day. In the Middle Ages, anyone hearing voices was judged to be possessed by demons or evil spirits and would have some appalling physical ritual inflicted on them, usually ending in death. In the 21st century, people who hear voices are judged to be suffering from a symptom of mental illness. In some people with schizophrenia, there is a fault in the auditory canal which can make their own internal thoughts sound as if they are being whispered in their ear by an invisible entity with a different voice to their own. Sustained experience of this would obviously be very distressing and disorientating, especially if the person was not aware of the physiological origins of the phenomenon. Talking to yourself in public has long been seen as a sign of madness, when in fact there is nothing unusual about giving voice to your thoughts. Everyone does it at one time or another. Further to this, many people in the street can nowadays be seen holding one-way conversations. They just happen to be attached to a mobile phone. In conclusion then, for this episode, as if I haven't already demonstrated how complicated the whole issue of consciousness and the external world is, I'll read a selection from the final paragraph of A.J. Ayer's book, The Foundations of Empirical Knowledge. The only way in which one can test whether a sense of perceptions is veridical is to see whether it is substantiated by further sense experiences. So that once again, the ascription of reality depends upon the predictive value of the sense data on which the perceptions are based. So long as the general structure of my sense data conforms to the expectations that I derive from the memory of my past experience, I remain convinced that I am not living in a dream. And the longer the series of successful predictions is extended, the smaller becomes the probability that I am mistaken. Admittedly, this progressive limitation of the probability of illusion can never reach a sense of a formal demonstration. The most that we can do is to elaborate a technique for predicting the course of our sensory experience and to adhere to it so long as it is found to be reliable. And this is all that is essentially involved in our belief of the reality of the physical world. Well, that's quite a thought to leave you with, isn't it? But time is up for this episode, which be the seventh one. I shall definitely be calling this episode Consciousness Part 1, as I think it's going to take a good 3 or 4 to get through this to any degree. That's the end of the episode. Hope you've enjoyed it. Hope to see you again next week. And the usual exhortation that if you enjoy this free podcast, then please like it on Facebook and post about it on all the interwebby places. And go to my website, marcusfreestone.com. Check out my free books and music and my comedy podcast. And if you feel that you're getting really a super amount of worth out of this podcast, then please consider forking out 99 cents for one of my ebooks, or I think $4 or $5 for one of my albums or EPs. Something for everyone there. See you next week. Bye.